Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Elveson. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Today's podcast conversation about education, about meaningful topics in education is Justin Cook, who's director of learning at the Ontario Alliance of Christian Schools. And Justin's taking a little bit of time today away from a group of teachers doing some professional learning and with our friend Stephen Levy. But Justin, you know, we had a conversation going back a couple months now on this idea of beautiful work and the beautiful worker. And it really is not something that I had thought about in that terminology and in that language. And then so so I asked some questions and you shared an article by Ron Berger of Expeditionary Learning, and in which he says about beautiful work, always in all subjects, there is the quest in my classroom for beauty, for quality, and we critique all that we do for its level of care, craftsmanship, and value. And I looked up one of your articles or one of your blogs that you wrote, and you talked about this beautiful work as being, our work is beautiful because it reveals coherence, interconnectedness, craftsmanship, and authenticity. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the beautiful worker, which is really where I want to ask some questions, but can you kind of give me an idea of how this idea of beautiful work or where this comes from or why this resonates so deeply with you?
Yeah, it's great. Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me. And hi, everybody. Well, like you, I think my attention to the focus on work, on beautiful work, also came through Ron Berger, reading Ethic of Excellence, and even participating in a couple sessions on him with him on beautiful work. And at the beginning of Ethic of Excellence, he uses this anecdote where he's talking about going to talk with educators about the importance of their work, and he's a bit stressed that the suitcase of student work that he travels with is going to go missing and that he'll have nothing to say. But then he does get his work, the student work arrives, and as soon as he sees the student work, his nerves are calmed because he knows that the work speaks for itself. And I was so struck by the way that as a leader in education, everything he wanted to communicate to educators could be said not through his voice, but through the work that the students had produced, that the work that the students had created and were proud of. And I was just struck as an educator myself, what have I helped students to be proud of in their accomplishments? What would they show to say, this is what I'm learning and this is how excited I am about it? And I made a personal commitment. I'm a systems leader now, in a sense, working with a district of schools. And I made a commitment to start creating my own gallery of work, just to celebrate and to pay attention to what work students have done. Two other quick anecdotes. One of our high schools in Ontario creates an anthology of student work every year called Notice, Toronto District Christian High School. They gather that work. It's some of it's playful, some of it's very deeply serious, some of it's writing, much of it is visual, some of it's mathematical. And I thought, isn't it amazing that they have this anthology of the student voices in their community? Not yearbook style, but actual learning style, what they've produced. And you get a real deep sense of that community just by looking at that work. The second thread I'll finish with here, Eric, is it's a gentleman named Philip Schlechte, who's passed on now, but he was a thinker in the States, and I read a book by him called Engaging Students. And again, that book starts by saying, so often we focus on professional development as teacher performance. What's the teacher doing? And let's listen and watch the teacher and focus on how to change the teacher practice. And that's good. That's fine. But he makes the case in that book that there's no better way to think about improving teacher practice than by looking at the work that comes out of that teacher space. and by thinking about how we can improve our practice by simply examining carefully the student work that comes out of that teacher's space. And this ties back in with Ron Berger and others, High Tech High, a student protocol, looking at a beautiful work protocol, where if we believe that beautiful work is complex, it has craftsmanship, it has authenticity, and it has purpose, why don't we look at the work to see which one of those characteristics is going well and which ones maybe we want to beef up a little more. So a school that's high on rigor might say, yeah, we're really good at complexity in student work, but we're not so good at authenticity. Or you might say, yeah, there's real great craftsmanship here, but we're not exactly sure what the purpose of the work is. So if we examine the student work, we can think about how to improve our own practice to continue to support students well.
So you know, and I think in our conversation, and that's an incredible setup to kind of ask the question of how we view the student differently. And you've used the term with me or in that the conversation that we had a couple months ago about the beautiful worker, and you were, you know, you thought it might be a little cheesy or, you know, you know, or whatever, but like in your mind is,
we can pull the audience, Eric, we can pull the audience and see whether is that a cheesy phrase or a really meaningful phrase.
And I mean, my encouragement, and that's why I'm excited to talk to you about it, because I think it's a very meaningful phrase, you know, especially for me, and a reminder of, you know, why I do what I do, or, you know, or what drives me, you know, forward in my career and in my profession and in this vocation. And so what was the shift for you as you thought about, okay, here's the beautiful work, but then the transition to saying, you know what, there's a worker behind that that's also beautiful? Mm-hmm. Or how do we kind of consistently go back to and focus in on the worker who also kind of builds and creates and develops this beautiful work?
If we only focus on the work, we're caught in that we're caught in a dangerous, idolatrous spiral of, you got to earn your identity and you have to earn your acceptance. And this is the flip side of the coin of focusing on student work. So if we only focus on student work, and we create this pressure around the fact that it has to be beautiful, it has to be quality, we end up on a treadmill that drives us to exhaustion and to failure and shame. And, you know, we have, for me, and I'm sure for many of the listeners, these are common passages, but I'll highlight two in order that are significant for me. One comes from Proverbs 8. I'm a pretty big fan of wisdom literature and scripture. And Proverbs 8 is this voice of woman wisdom calling out from the center of the square. And she calls out in a voice and says, you know, listen, everyone, I was there in the beginning. I was wisdom. I was craftsmanship at the very beginning as God was laying the foundations of the universe. And so we see that that wisdom in that passage is actually a craftsmanship, a quality of person, not just a result of creation. And the spirit hovering over the waters is this beautiful, is this beauty and craftsmanship. So that started sparking my sense of beauty as wisdom, in a sense, beauty as craftsmanship. But, you know, we have a couple co-friends, Eric. Dan Behrens comes to mind here. He and I both love very much Ephesians 2:10. And Ephesians 2:10 is speaking exactly to this danger that I'm referring to if we get stuck on this kind of treadmill of works. Ephesians 2:10 says, "For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God has prepared in advance for us to do." And since then, I've come across, in reference to Ephesians 2, this something called the cycle of grace. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this. If you just Google cycle of grace, you'll get a couple graphics. And they move through four stages. And the first is acceptance. First and foremost, we are known and we are loved by our Creator. We are redeemed as a free gift in grace by Jesus Christ. And so first and foremost, Ephesians 2:10 says, you are a beautiful work. You yourself are a beautiful worker. Then we get sustenance in the cycle of grace. Then we get significance in the cycle of grace. And finally, after all of that foundation of grace, we get achievement. And to me, that is the movement of Ephesians 2:10. First and foremost, you are beloved. You are a handiwork. You're a beautiful work that God has made, but He's prepared beautiful work for you to do in advance in Christ Jesus. So I think it's crucial over and over again as Christian communities, especially in schools that have inherited, you know, grade acquisition as kind of the legacy of education currently. First and foremost, we have to say students are beautiful workers. Teachers are beautiful workers. They've been freely accepted through Jesus Christ, but there's good work to do. There's beautiful work that He's prepared for us to accomplish. Let's get to it. Within that foundation of grace and acceptance and sustenance, let's achieve something significant.
So let me ask that question then. You know, is you talk about, you know, the idea of being accepted, being known, knowing yourself, you know, knowing in a sense the Creator, knowing the others, you know, that you're doing this work with. How do you value that, or how do you create time for that, or how do you, you know, create the community where you talk about these things, where the beautiful worker is valued and not like, you know, it is. I mean, I live in Silicon Valley where, you know, productivity and achievement and excellence and outcomes, you know, is what we drive to, and it diminishes, I think, what you're talking about here in the sense of who the person is and who they are, you know, in community with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Yeah, let's get practical. That's awesome. Yeah, here's where it hits the road, right, Eric? For sure. I'll give one example from elementary and one from high school. We've been mentioning Ron Berger, Stephen Levy, that the expeditionary learning system of schools has been a deep impact on me and my work. And one of the ways that that's concretely been explored is by visiting an expeditionary learning school in Rochester, New York, which is close to the border here on Ontario. So a few years in a row, we've taken teachers to Genesee. One thing we discovered there is they had amazing unified practices around creating culture in the classroom. And when we asked them how they got on the same page about the way they created culture, they talked about an organization in the United States called Responsive Classroom. And we researched Responsive Classroom and immediately recognized the way Responsive Classroom was creating concrete structures and practices that allowed students to develop social emotional learning alongside and woven into the academic learning. So a really quick example, they use a morning meeting structure or a morning advisory meeting to create community of learners, of students. And, you know, if you think about, you just asked me, how do kids be known and how do they experience being loved? Well, in the primary grades, in the younger grades, they use a morning meeting where every day students are greeted and greet each other by name. They learn how to greet each other and know each other's names. They share together in some way. They create community by knowing each other and sharing of each other's lives together. They do an activity which gets their brains active and their bodies active. And then there's a message from the teacher about excitement for the day. So every day at the start of the learning day, kids are greeted, they share together, they're active, and the teacher says, I'm excited to move forward into our learning together in this way. So that's one example where I think before anything happens, students are welcomed, you know, the teacher's at the door. There's this sense of being known and being valued and being loved. And there, if you notice there's a lot of voice, right? There's a lot of students being invited to share together in an open-ended way with structure, of course, and but they're not being told exactly what to do or say. There's a lot of student voice there. And I think that's all the more important as we move into high school. And again, we need to create cultures and structures where student voice is honored and where students can express who they're becoming and what they love and who they are. And the example I'll give here is just a shift we made at the high school I was teaching in a number of years ago. We were struggling with assemblies, and we primarily had adults at the front of the room in assemblies, you know, so kids were in bleachers for, 500 strong, and we had a lot of discipline problems, and it just seemed like we weren't doing it right. And so we tried to flip the script by saying, okay, from now on, we're going to use a student-led team to help plan our assemblies and our chapels. And one of our core commitments is to have students on the microphone as much as possible. So whatever we do, we're going to think about honoring students and allowing students to speak to students as opposed to adults speaking to students. We share the air in that way. And we're going to create ways that students are excited to be in front of each other as opposed to pushed there by adults. And that fundamentally shifted the culture of our assemblies. Just by allowing students to take lead, by allowing student voice to kind of step up and creating space for students to be themselves in front of each other and to celebrate each other.
So that takes a huge, amount of trust. Right. And also an embrace of ambiguity, an embrace of the unknown. We have our plans. We have our agendas. We have our thoughts, our directions. But when you leave it open in those ways, whether it be in that classroom or whether it be in something like assemblies, I can imagine, school leaders, being like, holy smokes, what can happen? How is a group of adults, do you have those conversations to remind yourselves and to build the relationships where they are relationships of trust, where you can embrace that ambiguity and go forward, not just adults to students, but then, adults with students and students mm-hmm. with adults and do it together.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, that's good. Maybe two thoughts come to mind, and I'm kind of grasping at this. So your question has challenged me, I think, in a great way. I would quickly add, let's stay with the high school example. That's not to say that as teachers, like if I was, and I was the assembly coordinator, that's not to say I had no idea what would happen in front of the microphone. I was still very much clear on what I was inviting students to do and what I was inviting them to contribute. But if they said no, they said no. I would never force a kid in front of the student body of 500 kids, of course. But often we as a group of students and myself planning the assemblies, we had a really clear idea of what was going to happen. And we tried to create structures that were playful as much as they were serious. So, some assemblies took a much more formal tone, but some were really playful and spontaneous. So for instance, I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you do a paper, rock, scissors tournament, right? And if you win, you stay in, right? Well, you can actually in about 10 minutes go from 500 people playing paper, rock, scissors to two people going head to head as a competition. So we had a clear structure. We didn't think people were going to, it's a bit of a risk, but we had a clear structure in mind about how we would have this spontaneous, playful paper, rock, scissors championship. And it surprised kids. It's like, whoa, we don't typically do this kind of thing in assemblies. And the second comment I was going to make there, Eric, is I think the adults have to live into that culture themselves if they're going to invite students into it too. So if we want assemblies to be playful, we need a certain level of comfortability as a staff to be playful. So could we see ourselves as a staff team of 40 playing a paper, rock, scissors tournament together? I would hope so. That sounds like fun to me. But if we can't be playful as staff in that way, I don't think there's any way that we'll, with authenticity and success, create that kind of culture with the students.
Yeah, I really appreciate, you know, just that idea of the playfulness, because as adults, we get so serious. And we take ourselves so serious. We take our profession serious, which is important, you know, and I can be the first one, you know, to do that. And, you know, where is the fun? Where's the joy of the silliness of the relationships of just the opportunity to be together and to do enjoyable things? I just think about like sports teams when they travel and they dress up or they do goofy things or, you know, whatever it might be. You know, hockey teams when they go playoffs and, you know, they got the big beards and, you know, and love and life.
Hockey players love that.
Yeah. And, you know, it is. It's the fun and it's the enjoyment of being together and doing something serious, but then knowing that this is a great opportunity, you know, just a great opportunity to be together and pursue great things together. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one last question and then we'll kind of close it up here because I think this is a great taste, not only for me in the conversation, but even for people who have the opportunity to listen and to embrace this, because you've given us a ton. And so I've got a lot of notes to go through as I write a blog, but I'm thinking, especially as you've transitioned into this new role or you've transitioned into a role where you're primarily dealing with adults. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes in my experience, you know, we move into these leadership positions and we talk about, you know, the beautiful worker being the kid. How have you transitioned this playfulness or even this idea of beautiful worker and beautiful work to the adults that you get to lead and guide and train and, you know, cultivate and facilitate, you know, their growth and their development as and find fulfillment in their work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say, you know, we just went through kind of a scaffolding of playfulness, playful seriousness, right? Beautiful worker as a playful thing, but also as very much focused on achievement. So we're all accepted. We all belong, but we have good work to do. Ephesians 2:10 says to us. And we want that culture in our classrooms. We want students to experience that. I just talked about it existing in our staff rooms, right? We want our staff and faculty lounges to have that kind of sense of beautiful, playful seriousness to them, honesty, authenticity. And then I think that for me, the challenge is, can we create that kind of ethos, that kind of culture in a whole entire system? And my system's pretty small. We're only about 70 schools. You know, there's about, like, give and take, maybe 800 to 1,000 teachers. But if we think about that community of inter-school culture, can we have a deeply playful and serious sense of beauty at that level? Because it trickles up and down, right? This sense of innovation and change and growth, it could happen from the bottom, from the middle, or from the top. So as it relates to what we're talking about, I've done whatever I can and some success and lots of failure to try and create alignment around these priorities, you know? So I love it when I hear the phrase beautiful work somewhere within our system of schools. And I see that, let's say, in a staff blog or a principal's, you know, Monday memo that the principal, she's talking about beautiful work. And so we start having conversation that is coherent and focused on this. But at district events or provincial events, the annual convention, we want inspiring voices that create that sense of balance between joy and peace and acceptance, but also clarity of purpose and direction and achievement. And so we want to keep bouncing kind of between that sense of playfulness and drive. Let's play together, but let's drive forward together. This is from Responsive Classroom again, but if I'm leading a district PD day, you know, right after lunch, we'll take a playful break. I'll do a rock, paper, scissors kind of spontaneous tournament championship and we'll celebrate together and, you know, create brain breaks and, you know, and these are, you know, this is good. Neuroscience tells us to do these things. And so just that ongoing alignment between staff experience, adult learning, and student learning. Can we kind of create coherence and alignment there? We should be using the best pedagogy to learn the best pedagogy, right? We just constantly want to embody good pedagogy as adult learners. And then as we model it together and experience it together, it's so much more easy and comfortable to actually embody it in our classrooms.
Justin, I know this is, these conversations are always short, but they're a taste of the good things that are happening. And I appreciate who you are and what you're doing, how you've impacted me just in a very short time. To think about things anew, fresh, with a different perspective. And so I really appreciate the impact that you've had on me through this, through these ideas and through this concept of beautiful work and the beautiful worker. So thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Blessings on your work too, man.
Thanks.